The purpose of tonight's forum is to discuss the need for and the value of balance between the masculine and feminine principles in us as individuals so that it could influence our culture and the larger world. So we're going to offer three glimpses into the effect of this balance or imbalance. Dan is going to talk about Jesus Christ, the perfectly integrated personality. David is going to discuss the Victorians, who are quite off balance, out of whack, and our similarity to them. And Anne is going to tell you about Wendell Berry's Unsettling of America philosophy, where he encourages us to seek this masculine-feminine balance, especially in relationship to the earth that we live on. We're going to ground this discussion in Carl Jung's understanding of the human psychology and Irene Claremont de Castillejo's Knowing Woman, a feminine psychology book. Jung defines an essential human journey that we're all on, a psychological journey. He calls it individuation. Individuation is a gradual process in our lives. It's a journey toward wholeness, a spiritual quest. For him, this wholeness is attained by reconciling parts of one's personality that you may not be aware of, the opposites that are within you, the intellect versus unconscious, masculine versus feminine, thinking versus feeling, the mask that we wear as we move through the world versus the shadowy, instinctive part of ourselves, which wants to do everything that our reason doesn't let us do. The opposites within us are very far apart. Castillejo says, our need is to keep the balance between masculine focused consciousness and woman's more diffuse awareness, or if you prefer, between the creative spirit, which uses man as its vehicle, and the life force, which uses women. Both of these great impersonal forces are equally ruthless. They meet in the human mind, and I believe it's the task of every individual man and woman to help humanize them both. It seems as if today we've lost this vital balance. Jung maintains that young people can better pay the price of being out of balance than we can as we get older. As one matures, it becomes more impossible to deny these dimensions, and the resultant feelings of unfulfillment are part of the crisis of people in midlife. For men, the unconscious has a feminine soul that must be reckoned with. Women should grow to know their masculine soul. And the more that you can be aware of these opposites, the further you move on this journey toward a whole integrated personality. A man in touch with his feminine might be more receptive, intuitive, feeling, or benevolent. A woman may be more focused, more intellectual, more adventurous, assertive, or confident. And the only way that you can develop the lesser functions within you is to give less energy to the first. I'll repeat that. The only way that you can begin to develop these lesser parts of your personality is to give less energy to the first.
First?
Meaning, if you're masculine, to give less emphasis to that side of you and try to be in touch with the other. If you... And there are lots of psychological terms for these things, but I'm not going to use them tonight. Any individual who progresses on this journey, reconciling the opposites, adds to a collective possibility which could influence a culture. That's why, in a patriarchy, every person's steps toward becoming a feminist would be progress for the whole culture. The culture would better attempt to balance its opposite poles in creative tension, a kind of yin and yang, or a Greek and Hebrew way of viewing the world. Our society, based on scientific knowledge and technical skill, forces men to develop one-sidedly, to sharpen their conscious minds and repress their instinctive ones. Women, too, are educated in this way to man's values, and they pay a price for such conscious development. And again, I'm going to quote from this woman I discovered this afternoon, an hour and a half before supper. On the whole, the menace to civilization today seems to come from man's overdeveloped thinking and the consequent adaptedness of his fourth dimension feeling, the undeveloped adaptedness of this fourth dimension, which lets in evil. His feeling brings with it all the dynamic forces of the unconscious, good and bad, courage and inspiration, but also terror, which makes us pile armament upon armament, hydrogen bomb upon hydrogen bomb. Jung maintains that our only hope of holding the blind, hysterical masses in check is for enough people to entertain and contain the opposites within themselves, instead of swinging violently from one extreme to the other, or projecting the undesirable opposite on an outer enemy. We do not yet know the extent to which a relatively few integrated persons could break the force of a rising storm, but their impetus is not that of numerical superiority, nor in the field of action. Their healing effect is in the unconscious, which we all share. This new meaning that people need in their lives is often best found in this neglected and undeveloped side of one's personality. But a lot of people can't face this, and so they pursue the values of youth into old age. For them, the process of individuation doesn't have any meaning. DiCastiello and Jung believe that a person should be centered, that in the last analysis, the cosmos and humans obey common laws. When one reconciles these opposites through individuation, one's personality becomes healed, liberated, and transformed. One becomes an individual in the fullest sense and then takes responsibility for the darker sides of ourselves. Again, I'm going to quote Irene DiCastiello. A new act of heroism is necessary for women in this culture. She must try to salvage her feminine values so that she can hold to her true self with such a firmness that her values can permeate society and check the disastrous course of materialistic progress and overpopulation upon which we are hurling ourselves pell-mell. Got questions?
Do you foresee to discuss these as we go along, or is it better to go through all the presentations?
I think probably go through.
Like to go through all the presentations, and
because this is sort of fundamental
to
what
whole
they're
thing.
Going to say.
And I need a piece of paper.
Here's half of one.
Yeah, I'm going to give just a very brief biblical background on the subject we're dealing with tonight. And there's two ways you could go. One would be, again, to deal with the topic of shalom, or the final unity of all creation moving towards a unity. And you can see that so closely in what Karen was talking about is in terms of male and female. I'm going to start, though, tonight with the other end. And that is with Genesis 1:31, from the creation story. God saw all he had made, and indeed it was very good. The Hebrew word here for good is tov, T-O-V. And the closest we can understand the meaning of this word is if you'd think of an artist or an artisan like Peter. And if Peter made the most beautiful pot he had ever made, and it was exactly the perfect pot that he'd had in his mind his whole life, and it finally was there, he'd step back at it and look at it, and he would say, tov. Do you get the meaning of the word? And that was the picture of God stepping back, looking at his whole creation, and saying, tov, you know, exactly what I wanted. Good. Now, from this affirmation, we get the biblical faith in the first article of the creed that everything created is good. And this, to move from there, is an affirmation that is so often denied. And the denial, or you might say the heresy, is how easy it is for us to decide that part of creation is not good. Three examples. Racism. White is good, black is bad. ageism. Young is beautiful, old is ugly. Do you see how this is a denial of the goodness of creation? And then sexism, maleness is good, femaleness is bad. One is superior, one is inferior. The sexism now takes two forms, and we've already mentioned that. One, as a denial of the goodness of all creation. One is a declaration that female people are inferior to male people. That's making the statement outside of myself. Then is the inner declaration that the female characteristics in me should be denied, and then the male characteristics should be affirmed. And again, when that decision is made, again, it is a denial of the goodness of all of creation. Then we can look at Jesus as the example of true human being. And often when we say Jesus is true human being, we often mean, oh, he's weak, you know, like all the rest of us, that he's a weak human, and forget to think of it in terms of Jesus being the whole, or having a wholeness of humanity about him. This is evident in his affirmation that all creation is good. And we know this especially in his relating to women as a man, relating to women, and also the recognition of both the femaleness and the maleness with himself. Is that a word, femaleness? Or am I making,
it is now.
Am I coining a word?
Sounds good.
I like it though. I'm going to use it. Write it down. Okay. Okay. In a society that severely subordinated women, we can read the Gospels and see how natural Jesus was in relating to women, how he granted them full dignity, the dignity that was given to women in the creation story. Obvious examples, Jesus and the Samaritan woman, Jesus and Mary and Martha, and the fact that Jesus had women in the company of disciples, Luke 8, Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Susanna. We can read the gospel in terms of seeing Jesus relating to women as people of dignity, the same as he related to men. Okay, then how Jesus lived in a wholeness within himself, where both the masculine and feminine were affirmed. And we can cite examples from what we often talk about as the femininity or masculinity. Holding children, an act that disgusted the disciples, remember? Weeping over Jerusalem, saying to Jerusalem, I wanted to be a mother hen and you wouldn't let me. That's Matthew 23 and Luke 13. Feeling pity for the sick and the needy, weeping in the garden. Then how the other side, just some examples, how he used very rational scholarship in arguing with the Pharisees. He did the very best job that the society knew in what was a very common form of debate. When you see Jesus and the Pharisees arguing. And then, of course, the most obvious example of aggressiveness, driving the money changers out of the temple. Jesus was truly human, and the example of this wholeness is in his relating to women, and also in being whole with himself by these examples. Now, indications are that the earliest church followed the example of Jesus in giving equal dignity and giving leadership responsibility to women. The first century church wrote the New Testament, where the style of Jesus is affirmed. The second century church allowed this affirmation of women in the life of Jesus to remain in the text. Names of women, in Acts 8 and 9, men and women are imprisoned. Acts 18, Priscilla is a teacher of the way. Romans 16, Phoebe is a deaconess. Priscilla is Paul's fellow worker. Galatians 3:28, there is neither male nor female, possibly a fragment of an early baptismal statement. When you were baptized, before you went into the water, you affirmed there's neither male nor female. What happened? The Gnostic heretics of the early church championed the cause of women's rights in the church, and they based this on denying the physical, in other words, saying the distinctions are unimportant. And when the Orthodox Church rejected Gnosticism, the Orthodox Church also rejected the cause, one of the causes of Gnosticism, and that was their champion of women's equality in the early church. And the church, we know, has never recovered. We've all grown up in male churches, and we live in a world that's a male-dominated church. And the loss is the loss of the leadership of women. And there's a spiritual loss, because through this the church has taught each of us in some way, to, especially us men, to only affirm our masculinity and to deny our femininity. And okay.
I believe that today's patterns of personal and social behavior between men and women have their roots in the far distant past, and that these patterns were firmly reaffirmed and reinforced in the Victorian period, primarily the 19th century, which is the period of time which I spend most of my time doing research in. I'd like to explain two different dualities about Victorian attitudes about the relationship between men and women. The first is the notion or doctrine of the separate spheres. You talked about men and women having separate spheres. And the other notion is the notion, the attitude that the male-oriented society had toward women, considering that women were either wife or whore. I think with some modifications and maybe with slightly different terminology, these attitudes still thrive today. Now, I don't have all my primary texts with me, but if you're interested in pursuing this a little bit, one place where there's a chapter on it is in Kate Millett's book, Sexual Politics, which was published 10 years ago. The doctrine of the separate spheres was most persuasively preached about and then written by John Ruskin, who was one of the main critics of the in the Victorian period. He gave a speech and later printed it in a book in 1864 called Of Queen's Gardens. He had given an earlier talk called Of King's Treasuries, where he talked about the men's sphere in the world. This one is about women's sphere. And what he and others did in the Victorian period was to notice that there were some natural biological differences between men and women. And using that as a basis for argument, therefore justified a whole range of economic, political, educational, domestic, and sexual differences, all of which subordinated women to the position of men. One of the most influential philosophers and sociologists of the Victorian period, Herbert Spencer, even went so far as to claim in one of his major writings that the reason that women were not intellectually equal with men, but were distinctly inferior, was that at puberty, all of the inner energies in women went toward the process of childbearing, and therefore no longer went towards the development of the intelligence. And therefore it makes no point at all to educate women in the same way that you educate men, because the life forces that go to help the mind develop have been diverted in women toward the development of childbearing. I'll read a brief quotation or two from Ruskin's Of Queen's Gardens so you can hear the language he uses to make this point. Now, their separate characters are briefly these, that is, men and women. The man's power is active, progressive, defensive. He is eminently the doer, the creator, the discoverer, the defender. His intellect is for speculation and invention. His energy for adventure, for war, and for conquest. But the woman's power is for rule. Remember, this is spoken in the time when the ruling monarch in England was Queen Victoria, who was queen for 64 years, two-thirds of the century. The woman's power is for rule, not for battle. And her intellect is not for invention or recreation, but sweet ordering, arrangement, and decision. By her office and place, she is protected from all danger and temptation. The man, in his rough work in the open world, must encounter all peril and trial. To him, therefore, must be the failure, the offense, the inevitable error. Often he must be wounded or subdued, often misled, and always hardened. And one other spot. I'm going to read from John Stuart Mill next. The main opponent to Ruskin was John Stuart Mill, the great Victorian philosopher, who in 1869, 5 years after Ruskin's publication of Queen's Gardens, wrote a book called The Subjection of Women. He was a feminist, as was his wife, and he worked hard in the House of Commons to have the Reform Bill of 1867, which was extending the vote to more men than had had the vote already, to have it extended to women, but he was soundly defeated. And 2 years later, he published his book on the subjection of women and presented a strong case on the opposite view. Here's what Mill says. Standing on the ground of common sense and the constitution of the human mind, I deny that anyone knows or can know the nature of the two sexes so long as they have only been seen in their present relation to one another. What is now called the nature of woman is an eminently artificial thing, the result of forced repression in some directions, unnatural stimulation in others. In other words, he was making the point that all of these differences that people were attributing to women from men were not natural differences, but were ones that were socialized. That is, we educated and trained and even legally made women subordinate so that all members of society, including women, thought that they were subordinate. He talks about education. Here's how he describes education. People are little aware how early the notion of his inherent superiority to a girl arises in the boy's mind, how it grows with his growth and strengthens with his strength, how it is inoculated by one schoolboy upon another, how early the youth thinks himself superior to his mother, owing her perhaps forbearance, but no real respect, and how sublime and sultan-like a sense of superiority he feels above all over the woman whom he honors by admitting her to a partnership of his life. Is it imagined that all this does not pervert the whole manner of existence of the man, both as an individual and a social being? And then, finally, Mill says, they are declared to be better than men. Here he's talking about this argument that women have their sphere in which they are actually better than men. That is, they are to rule the home, to provide comfort and nourishment in the home, and therefore men put women on a pedestal and said, we don't think women are inferior, we think that we honor them, we revere them. They are the cornerstone of our society. Mill says that they are declared to be better than men an empty compliment which must provoke a bitter smile from every woman of spirit, since there is no other situation in life in which it is the established order, that is, that women are superior to men, and considered quite natural and suitable that the better should obey the worse. Now, if you have clear in your mind the sense that there's a sphere of life for women, and that's the home, where she takes care of things there while the man is out in his sphere of life, in commerce, war, politics, and so forth, you have the sense that this kind of chivalric notion that the woman is superior. Now, this is the first half of the second dichotomy of woman as wife. The Victorian wife literally owned nothing. When she married, she lost all of her possessions. They became her husband's possessions. So if the marriage ever dissolved, the woman owned absolutely nothing. It wasn't until 1857 that there was the first of marriage laws that improved this. The woman was seen as having the duty to serve the husband. She was at all times to be submissive, that she was in the role of caring for the sentiment, that she was to take care of religion, that is, the religious teaching of the children. She was, in a sense, to be the conscience of men. Mill called this domestic slavery. And I think that it's still, this concept is still used as a convenience by many in our society to see to it that women are in the place where they want them to be. The only legitimate life outside the home that the proper Victorian woman had was to do charitable things. We still see this in our emphasis on volunteerism now. It was her job, because the men were too busy fighting wars and in politics and in commerce, to care for the poor and the needy, to be the conscience. And men found this a very convenient thing to do as well, because it allowed them to wash their hands of trying to resolve the problems which they were creating through the kind of problems of the Industrial Revolution. And then the Victorian wife was assumed to be largely non-sexual. That is, the proper Victorian wife did not have sexual feelings, only rarely, if any at all, and certainly not as strong as those of the man. The Victorians had large families, so we know that there was sexual intercourse within families, but women were raised to think of it as a duty, an abhorrent duty, but one which they had to obey. The men, on the other hand, since their wives were really not fit to engage in much sexual activity with, turned to other women. And here's the other half of the view of Victorian women. If a woman was not a proper wife, she obviously fell into the other camp, and that was to be a temptress or a prostitute. There was a severe double standard in the Victorian period. It was considered perfectly normal for men to be visiting prostitutes regularly, even if they were married. Because after all, one couldn't expect one's wife to engage in very much sexual activity. After all, she found it distasteful. This goes back to the old sense of women as Eve, the tempter of men. And the Victorians found it very convenient to blame women if things went wrong in the world. That is, they were honored by being given the sphere of caring for the religious and moral aspects of life, to be the conscience of the country. And therefore, if there was evil in the world, women had to be behind it and at the base of it. So the Victorians had either, or actually both, the chauvinistic attitude towards women as sex object and the chivalric attitude of the woman who was this remarkable, non-sexual, charitable person who provided the comforts of whom. Then the last thing I want to say is that you may be familiar with the suffragette movement. If you've watched Shoulder to Shoulder on television, we think of Victorian feminism in terms of the trying to get the vote for women. And it's true that what happened was that the main focus of Victorian feminism turned out to be trying to get the vote for women. And that sidetracked all the other issues about equality amongst men and women. And when World War I came along, just at the time that women were getting the vote, the women's contributions to the war effort were so immense in most countries that finally the last resistance to giving them the vote broke down. And then when the war was over and women had the vote, the women's movement virtually died out for about 40 years until in the 60s the issues have come to the surface again. But once more, it was very convenient to assume that women had equality in all things because they had the vote. It might be interesting to know a couple of dates. Oxford University allowed women to receive a degree in 1920. And in Cambridge, they waited until 1948 before women would be granted a degree. Just to refresh your memories, in the United States, women got the vote in 1920. In England, women got the vote in 1928. And the final fact is that in Norway, women got the vote in 1913. There must be a moral there somewhere.
How about Sweden?
In Sweden, they still don't vote. Neither do the men, though.
Wendell Berry illustrates beautifully a number of modern myths regarding men and women. I'm going to read from two different sections for you. There is no doubt that women have been deformed by the degenerate housewifery that is now called their role, but not, I think, for any man's benefit. If women are deformed by their role, then insofar as the roles are divided, men are deformed by theirs. Degenerate housewifery is indivisible from degenerate husbandry. There is no escape. This is the justice that we are learning from the ecologists. You cannot damage what you are dependent upon without damaging yourself. The suffering of women is noticeable now, because it is not given any considerable status or compensation. If we removed the status and compensation from the destructive exploits we classify as manly, men would be found to be suffering as much as women. They would be found to be suffering for the same reason. They are in exile from the communion of men and women, which is their deepest connection with the communion of all creatures. For example, a man who is in the traditional sense a good farmer is husbandman and husband, the begetter and conserver of the earth's bounty, but he is also midwife and motherer. He is a nurturer of life. His work is domestic. He is bound to the household. But let progress take such a man and transform him into a technologist of production, that is, sever his bonds to the household, make useless or pointless or uneconomical his impulse to conserve and to nurture, and it will have made of him a creature as deformed and as pained as it has notoriously made of his wife. Perhaps the most dangerous, certainly the most immediately painful consequence of the disintegration of the household is this isolation of sexuality. The division of sexual energy from the functions of household and community that it ought both to empower and to grace is analogous to that other modern division between hunger and the earth. When it is no longer allied by proximity and analogy to the nurturing disciplines that bound the household to the cycles of fertility and the seasons, life and death, then sexual love loses its symbolistic or ritualistic force, its deepest solemnity and its highest joy. It loses its sense of consequence and responsibility. It becomes autonomous, to be valued only for its own sake, therefore frivolous, therefore destructive even of itself. Those who speak of sex as recreation, thinking to claim for it a new place, only acknowledge its displacement from creation. The isolation of sexuality makes it subject to two influences that dangerously oversimplify it. The lore of sexual romance and capitalist economics. By sexual romance, I mean the sentimentalization of sexual love that for generations has been the work of popular songs and stories. By means of them, young people have been taught a series of extremely dangerous falsehoods, the first being that people in love ought to conform to the fashionable models of physical beauty, and that to be unbeautiful by these standards is to be unlovable. The second, that people in love are or ought to be young, even though love is said to last forever. The third, that marriage is a solution, whereas the most misleading thing a love story can do is to end happily with a marriage, not because there's no such thing as a happy marriage, but because marriage cannot be happy except by being made happy. The fourth, that love alone, regardless of circumstances, can make harmony and resolve serious differences. The fifth, that love will find a way and so finally triumph over any kind of practical difficulty. The sixth, that the right partners are made for each other or that marriages are made in heaven. The seventh, that lovers are each other's all or all the world to each other. And the eighth, that monogamous marriage is therefore logical and natural and forsaking all others involves no difficulty. Believing these myths, a young couple could not be more cruelly exposed to the abrasions of experience or better prepared to experience marriage as another of those grim and ironic modern competitions in which the victory of one is the defeat of both. The discussion is open to everyone.
I'll just make a couple of addenda in a couple of those areas, not so much comments, but just additions in some of those areas.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've enjoyed in working in Long Beach has been teaching a class at a university with a woman for about 5 years on male-female roles. And as a part of that, I've been educated a great deal into the issues of both the women's and the men's movement. I hope when we talk about the embryonic men's movements at some point in the evening. It's not a whole lot to say because it's so embryonic, but we can say a few things about what some of the issues are there. But a couple things just occurred to me that might be added to what's been said so far. In the area of the biblical, one of the chief issues that very often back in Genesis gets raised by the forces who would keep women and men in predetermined roles of superiority or subordination is the creation of men and women, or the woman out of man's side story. I think it's exciting to also look to the other creation story. We have two accounts of creation in Genesis, and I think that one needs to be underlined in the case where women and men are created simultaneously. So we have, in a sense, almost a subordinating kind of story with the out-of-the-side story. We also have a sort of an equal story where men and women are created simultaneously. Another point, in the New Testament, where the women who were with Christ, and particularly Mary Magdalene and Mary, Mother of Jesus, in their greeting Christ in the resurrection account, a good case has been made by a number of people that the only true disciples with the women who surrounded Christ, and the reason being was they really understood Christ's mission. They really saw that the gospel that he was preaching was a gospel which was not directed towards the messianic expectations that, for example, Peter had of bringing a new kingdom, which would be a very masculine sounding kind of gospel, and one which men would very quickly want. Women were perhaps more prepared by virtue of their understanding that particular kind of intuitive or feeling or sensitive kind of compassion level, that they were more prepared and more ready for Christ and have a lot more to say and also are much more ready for Christ's coming and resurrection. A quick thought in the area of psychology and psychophysiology. One from Eric Frome In his book, The Art of Loving, I remember way back when I was starting college reading that book, and it was a very influential book in my thinking. He wanted, in one place, calls Jesus' love, mother love. I think it's a very important point that he makes, that the kind of love which Christ had, that he really demonstrates perhaps most clearly in his self-sacrificial death on the cross, is, if we can speak stereotypically, more of a feminine kind of love. It's the kind of love where mothers, like the mother pelican, I believe, one of the symbols, ancient Christian symbols, of ripping open the pelican's breast to save the life of the young, which is not the way a man would save the life of the young, but would attack and would fight. And so the notion that Frohn suggests of mother love, I think, is a very helpful psychological notion in the book The Art of Loving. One exciting thing in the area of psychophysiological research, that's being done right now, I think it's alluded to as prefigured in Jung's sort of speculative psychology, when he talks about the masculine and the feminine and the subconscious and the unconscious. Research is being done now, and I'm sure some of you are aware of the studies being done in right and left hemisphere brain work, where but I always get this wrong, the right hemisphere is the cognitive, right? Is that right? Mm-hmm.
Left is rational.
Of the brain is it's one way or the other. In any event, the right, I believe, is the cognitive, thinking, computer-like, activity-oriented side of the brain, whereas the left part of the brain is, and that's very often seen as the masculine, stereotypically, and the left is the intuitive, feeling level, that kind of integrative kind of quality of the brain, or part of the brain. That research has been done by some very exciting people. One is named Robert Samples, who's done some beautiful things in the notion of the metaphoric mind in literature. A lot of that's being superseded already by more current research. One of the most exciting researchers is a person named Carl Pivram at Stanford, who has said that may be oversimplifying it, that it may not be right and left hemisphere of your brain so much that's masculine and feminine, that it needs to get connected and integrated. Each cell of the body, in cellular study that's being done now, seems to have the same kind of components. And it's not just up here, it's something that's throughout us all. We are, in a cellular, deeply, cellular sense, we are masculine and feminine. And that's an exciting kind of physiological bit of research, because I think a lot of times people, when they kind of go back to that physical argument, men and women are different. And, they don't really see it on the kind of level we're talking about here. Just a quick word, too, on the men's movement, and this might raise some questions later on. In the same way that Kate Millett and Germaine Greer and others sort of sounded the call of women's movement in the early 60s, a man named Warren Farrell, who's written a book called The Liberated Man, began discussing some issues around men's liberation about 7 or 8 years ago now. Not many people, among men especially, have listened or have responded. There have been, however, a number of national conferences, a couple of which I've been able to attend, on men's issues. The issues have been, in some ways, very encouraging, some very self-seeking. But a couple of the issues that have come up in this men's consciousness movement have been, one, the issue of men and children. The way the division of the spheres has worked, when divorce has taken place, or separation has taken place, is the burden of proof is on the man that he could be a parent. The woman is generally, in most cases, understood to be the mother and therefore closer to her child and therefore should have custody of the child. There are a number of men who have fought such cases in the courts but have generally been defeated because women are better parents. And I agree that in most cases women are better parents, but it's an issue that men have raised because men have thought that some men have wish to be better parents and raise that kind of women's issue. Another, which I think is kind of exciting, is the possibility of paternity leaves, working with a number of corporations. That maternity leaves have been a battle for women, the women's movement, but there are a number of men who feel that, it's not just the woman's role at the time of the birth of the child to be available and to do nurturing and child rearing, that men should be able to have that same kind of time away from or release time from work to be able to do more fathering early in the child's development. And then the one other one, which is a real stickler,
and goes to the point of that was raised about women not having anything if they were divorced. That obviously has flip-flopped radically. So today, when their divorce takes place, it's the man who pays the woman. That's an issue which a lot of men are very angry about, and will become an issue, and I hope will be a divisive issue, which will keep feminist men from working in allegiance or alongside of women who would have similar causes. So, the agenda and perhaps some provocations.
My first question I wrote down after you spoke there is one which another to touch on too. I wanted to know, I guess, what your sources thought or what you thought, whether these two character groupings, I'm not sure how to talk about that. Is that clear in the context of what you said?
Masculine and feminine?
Yeah, well,
with all their...
Yeah, character groupings, meaning like intuitive, I mean, one of your people talk about that. Intuitive knowledge rather than specific knowledge, mm-hmm. and so on. Whether those are physically sex related. In other words, is a man at least 51% likely, you know, to have the masculine group with the so-called feminine group somewhere in there, but somewhat less? Is it actually physical, or would it be a good guess that this is a 50-50 thing and that the balance is caused by simply by socialization or culture?
It's very difficult to tell because no one has ever been raised outside of a culture or a conditioned kind of environment.
It's almost a moot question.
Yeah, it's really hard to tell that. I think that the psychologists feel that there are some really innate differences. But how you separate those from the conditioned ones is still difficult to know. I think that they feel also that evidence bears itself out, that there are characteristics that one sex has more than the other sex. The intellectual reasoning, technological progress kind of attitude being masculine, and the more intuitive or circular emotion of going through life being feminine.
You say that that there is no culture in which there is no set male and female gender type thing, right? Comes to my mind of what I've studied on Tibetan culture, the high Tibetan lamas and stuff, where the male was on the equal basis of the female in the training that they went through, the spiritual training. Mm-hmm. They believed that there was different spiritual levels that you could attain. And in their trainings, it was never used the story of the man or the story of the woman. It was always the story of this animal and this animal, but it was never explained that there is a male animal or a female animal. Now, if it's any kind of help at all, if you can find out more on the Tibetan culture, you might be able to find out more of an answer of what is possible if you can eliminate this male and female that you're pointing out.
Yeah, that would be really interesting.
I think a lot of it is cultural. I didn't know enough anthropology, but we did a few case studies, and one tribe called the Arapesh, who live in, I think it's the mountains towards Nepal in northern India. There they have, the males are the ones who concentrate on physical beauty and are very docile and placid, and the women are the ones who are aggressive and should take charge. And it's difficult to, I mean, it's just one little example, but I think a lot of the ways, maybe even the ways of thought, and certainly the idea of aggressive and docile, I'm sure that's cultural more than inherent.
I think the reason why I wanted to bring that up is that I've got, you know, kind of an axe to grind too, I suppose. I hear two different themes going here. I hear one of the division or these two clusters of character traits, which sometimes you get out of balance. And so there's the question of balance. Mm-hmm. is one issue.
Yeah.
And then the question of their identification with male and female is quite another issue, related but separate. I'm not at all sure that when we mix those up, that some good deal of confusion doesn't result. For instance, in the Ruskin, is that right?
Yeah.
In the Ruskin reading, when you read from the Queen's Garden thing where Ruskin said that women rule and that they establish sweet order, there's sort of a giggle at that phrase, you know. In other words, we've got some kind of a judgment about sweetness, which is sort of, you know, sort of mixed. It may not be, I certainly don't think he meant that as a slam, but we heard it as one, for example.
He presents it as a very favorable description of women.
Mm-hmm.
The first woman was elected to House of Commons in 1919. He wrote this half a century earlier, saying that it's the woman's role to rule. Women had never been allowed to serve in the legislative houses of England. He meant ruling in the home, you know, having rule over this little nest that one prepares for the man to come home to.
Yeah, there's even that third problem of spheres of activity. I just think. Sometimes I feel the same way about some of the women's movement literature as I do about some of the black liberation writing, which is that I see, for instance, some of the black people were saying, we want televisions, we want to get into this thing too, we want the goodies. And my feeling was that they were perhaps giving up what they already had, which was in some ways so much better.
Right.
And I fear for some women who also are struggling to get into a world which I think is smaller than the one that they're in now.
Yeah, Keith, I don't want to imply that either side should sell out to the other, because that's really not part of it. And in this book that I read this afternoon, it points out two dangers for women if they sell out. One is that they fall into the same power attitude that has been pervasive in the culture that they live in. And the other is that they get so much inner rage going about the fact that the feminine principle in our culture is so deeply buried that they are out of control, that the inner rage and the power can make witches of women. And they really caution against that.
I think the last thing that women want to be is like men. They look at the way in which men have this imbalance of many of the destructive factors of human nature, and yet achieving a balance is never going to occur until women have achieved some kind of strong voice in politics, economics, their domestic situation, and so forth. So with some of the feminists, they have to fight to try to get some political power. You know, we don't have a female senator, for instance, in this country. Until enough women are in positions to be able to influence some changes, it's either not going to happen or it'll happen much slower. So I think that gives the impression that the end goal for some feminists is to be like men. But I think that really the end goal is much beyond that, and getting some of the power that is now primarily male is simply a step on the way to a better end.
That was kind of a problem for me. I read Warren Farrell, is it Farrell? His book on the liberated man, and I agree with him that it has to come from both sides, that there has to be a liberating masculine roles and feminine roles, but also and it seems like, Karen and I were talking once about how it seems to have to come from the feminists, or the women have to start the thing, to, like David was saying, there has to be some initial attempts to get some power. But then it seems like so many different people are at so many different stages. Like, some women already have power, and they want to move toward a more humanist movement where everyone kind of moves to a better position, and some women are still there trying to get.
And I think some people will stay at some stages. Not. That's the flaw of human character. It's the blacks wanting to be white for a while, and then when they realized they didn't want that anymore, then they were very angry and violent. And it takes coming back to some kind of centering of the qualities. But there are going to be abuses of both of these attitudes, I think. Some women are going to stay out of line about their attitudes on feminism, and some men are never going to think it's worth the time of day to think about. I think there'll be all gradations of moving through those stages that you're talking about.
In that initial step where women are becoming senators, how do men become involved in the movement?
How would they
men become involved in the movement? It seems like a real tough time in the movement, a real threatening thing for men.
To have women becoming senators?
During that initial time.
They could be.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, I think it's a very good thing, but.
Well, it is threatening to many males. The whole thing is because it's a challenge to our way of thinking and the way we are. And anyone who has kind of your basic means of existence under great attack, you feel threatened. Even if you can rationalize the fact that the way I am is not as good as it should be, but when it's under attack, there's a lot of threat. And I'm afraid that the opposition is going to misuse whatever power they might get.
That happens at, very big political levels, but it happens at the most subtle little interpersonal levels. I think when we talk about men being threatened by women in politics, that's rhetorical. That's not a threat that most men feel in their guts. What they really feel in their guts, and try in this experiment sometime, is really a woman taking an assertive role in a relationship. That's scary. Because both very consciously and unconsciously, we men have made the decisions in many areas. We have sort of taken the lead, whether it's from simple things like opening doors to asking a person out, to, all sorts of things like that. Farrell does it in one of his workshops, a reverse role date situation.
Yeah.
The guys say, gosh, I wish women would ask me out. We all kind of fantasize, isn't that neat? But the process, unless you're pretty free as a man, as a person, is so different that it's scary.
Yeah.
It really, really is. And I think we have to sort of almost begin on a personal level with discussing these things, because we can talk grand political and social kinds of levels, but what really hits us and impacts us is in our day-to-day relationships. And that's one of the real gifts the women's movement has given, I think, is the women's consciousness raising groups, small groups of women who gather together and share what's going on with them on a feeling level, not from their heads, first of all, which is the male model, have been so powerful. And the few men's groups that I've been a part of have been really revolutionary for me.
It's so hard because some people are so far beyond other people.
Mm-hmm. You're going to find that everywhere, though, about
another
everything.
Another question that I'd like to raise is, okay, trying to look at it from a realistic point of view, which you said, Anne, going back to your last statement, okay, he says, yeah, it's great, it'd be nice for a woman to be able to love and ask you to go out. It'd be nice if you could live in a relationship like that, where she could be assertive whenever she wanted to, all right? But it seems to me like it goes back to your last statement, what is a victory for one is a defeat for both. Because with the way society is, and no guarantee of when it's going to change that way of thinking, which doesn't mean that it won't have to ever change. Don't get me wrong, I'm not
mm-hmm.
making a statement. Okay, say you meet this magical woman, right, this one of a kind, this real miracle, and you go out and try to work it in the world, you both could end up being defeated, it seems to me.
Well, I like to make the analogy, Jerry, in Wendell Berry's book, when he's talking about how difficult it is for us to live constructively in a destructive society.
he says it's really hard, even when you're aware of it. We live in a destructive society, and to keep from being that way yourself is hard. But all the little steps that you take help.
Right.
And I think that that one can compare that with becoming aware of this need for another dimension in our lives, that at every small step that we take individually may have some implication for the culture as a whole.
Right.
And the more people that we can get to have that happen to, the more exciting it is. I was talking with somebody the other day about trying to figure out the opposite of the word feminism. And I would have had to make up a word, I guess. I don't think there is one. And I think the feminism is a doctrine, a kind of power or political doctrine, and it's been born because we live in a patriarchy. If we lived in a matriarchy and everything were just as out of balance as it is right now, then I think there'd be a word for needing to shift it again.
Matriarchy being the opposite of patriarchy?
Matriarchy meaning having women being in charge in all the power situations.
It occurred to me as you were laying this thing out, also another one of my favorite theories, which I'm not sure where it goes. But out there, like some other people can see further than I can. The print, the words on the page, like you said, war, commerce, and politics were in the men's sphere. Print, publishing, and such, as an extension and growth of technology, also I think have fallen largely in the sphere of the masculine constellation of characteristics. And in fact, women authors did have quite a struggle, I believe. And some of them felt that they had to write under a man's name to be accepted.
Right.
They did have to,
right,
in order to be published and so on. And so when we talk about this, we're using a vocabulary which has been in part developed by men, or within this constellation of characteristics. Now, what happens is what you just mentioned. There's a word in this for the people outside who are trying to get in, but there's no word for the insiders trying to get out, because that's not thought of within that system. Mm-hmm. I think, though, that doesn't mean that there hasn't been another center of power. It's simply that it hasn't been seen or recognized or acknowledged by that constellation, particularly when it's feeling threatened or competitive, or when it's feeling like it's all alone. Not threatened or competitive, but simply no company. Doesn't recognize anything else.
Right. It's a little bit like the thing we're discussing in Winter Program now, the nations that have economic wealth and power, as opposed to the nations that don't. The ones who have the power, we just don't see the problem. That we don't sense that we are squashing, whole peoples by our behavior. Our lifestyle is comfortable to us, so we want to continue it. And it's those who have been subjected and subordinated, who are teaching us liberation theology and economics and so forth.
But there's two things that are happening, and that's a real good example. Because we rich also tend to think that the poor really are inferior in some way. And we proclaim that in so many ways to those poor people. And they tend to accept it and believe it.
Yeah.
They tend to think that there really is something wrong with them, that they really are more stupid. They're less educated, but that doesn't mean that they're stupid, for example. They're less less well-dressed, but it doesn't really mean that they're less beautiful. These are all our standards, and so all the words that we use to describe it tend to, carry this implied judgment.
Yeah, that's right.
I think this is true in the sexual area, too.
Yeah.
That the judgment that is implied in the language tends to be accepted by those others to whom it's directed, be they men who have feminine feelings or characteristics, or women who get it directly just because they're a woman, no matter what their psyches look like. But the great mistake or the great problem would be to not recognize that there has been and still is a force outside of this language. For instance, My mother, I'm sure, has fit well within a lot of these stereotypes. And growing up in South Dakota puts our family somewhere behind, you know, the leading edge. In other words, these things start on the coast and then they kind of work out. And South Dakota's right in the middle, so it's probably going to be
somewhere behind the leading edge. Yeah.
So I'm from South Dakota too, Keith.
Do you think there's some truth in that?
Yeah.
Sure. And so that gives me an advantage and care too of seeing something that some haven't been able to see quite so well because they've started out for no longer the track. My mother was, I believe, in that and still is to some degree, certainly, but she surely was when she was raising me up. But she had a tremendous influence and power over me. And that influence has not stopped.
But that's been seen by a lot of people to be a destructive one, Keith, and it has happened with lots of women within families, and that the domineering mother and the smothering influence of mothers, and it happens. I'm using an extreme kind of thing, but the reason people feel badly about that is that women don't have any other sphere to put their energies into, and so they become compulsive in the small one that they've got. And they, in lots of situations, you'll find, I'm not saying that's true of yours or even of my situation, but they'll run roughshod over quite a few people nearby them.
I think the point is that when people are pushed into funny-shaped places, mm-hmm. that where there is an opening, they do extend mm-hmm. out. And if that's the only sphere where women were allowed to be preeminent, mm-hmm. then they worked on that like crazy, mm-hmm. and the results, you know, have been.
Well, there are names for women like that, Tooth Mother, and.
But there's more. There's more, though. More. I mean, it isn't all bad news. I mean, a human person finding a way to exercise her humanity in a cramped place still had love and concern and intelligence. She was not ugly. She was not stupid. She may not have been terribly educated, but she wasn't stupid. And so certain things were brought to a very fine point. It's not all bad news.
But one of the things that we've finally come to discover is that one of the problems is that some people like your mother didn't have a choice of any other way of fulfilling potential. And this is what we've come to recognize, that the balance of male and female suggests that all worthy human endeavors should be equally accessible to males and females.
The curious thing is that you hear me somehow, the way I'm coming across, you're hearing me as though I'm speaking against that, and that's not at all what I need to do.
No, I just wanted to point up the fact, I mean, my mother is very much like your mother. She was a terrific mother, but if she had wanted to go into some other sphere, it would have been very difficult, and she would have had to battle all sorts of forces to do it. And you know, we know that some women do make it in male-oriented professions and vocations. And we see women have equal opportunity because there was this woman doctor and that woman preacher and so forth. But forgetting that for most women, they've chosen that sphere of the home, perhaps, and nurturing children, which is a worthy vocation. Because if they didn't choose that sphere, there was nothing.
But that's... Okay, you say if they didn't choose that, then there was nothing.
Yeah.
The thing is that, you know, there wasn't nothing.
Yeah, that's right.
There really couldn't be. People couldn't live if there wasn't
that's
something.
That's right, yeah.
But there has been something. That's what I'm trying to say. It's not like anybody has to start from nothing. The gifts are there.
That's
it's not
right.
That we haven't made odd-shaped places for ourselves to live in, because I'm sure we have.
Yeah.
You know,
it disturbs me, though, when sometimes our approach to this seems to be that we have to take some people from a state of nothingness and make them into something, when in fact they already are something. and something very good, as well as sometimes something very bad. And we are too, so we're on absolutely equal ground at that point. And not unequal at all. And it isn't that I have to give something that I've got to somebody who doesn't have it. But in fact, that I have to accept something from the same place that the other person has to also. I mean, there's a subordination, all right, but it's subordination to God, and myself and my sisters are accepting something from Him, or from that source, if you will. And we're not unequal at all.
So I'd like to transfer this to, you know, that it's, I think it's the same subject, but in one area, and then maybe move it to the village here. And I'd like to just some observations from being in a very normal congregation for 4 years. You know, and my mind has been kind of wandering through the halls of the parish, you know, and seeing different things. Women in the kitchen, men running most of the business of the church, the women cleaning up after communion as the men sit out in the pew waiting till she finishes. A woman who's very assertive in the church is crazy and bitchy. A man who's assertive is a good leader. Then there's a group of men over here that are telling dirty jokes, or kind of, there's men over here that aren't able to relate to women who are assertive. The only way they're able to relate is by kind of joking around and kind of a strange kind of flirting. I think you know what I mean. And once a woman refuses to relate on the level of flirting, that those men just aren't able to relate at all. Then a reality for me in this parish is I can relate to some men, but I can relate to most of the women. And I find here at Holden it's much more equal for me of relating to both men and women than it is in the parish, which is interesting. So that's just some observations, and I think it'd be interesting to say, what's it like in our village? You know, do we see any of these same dynamics? Or
who's better off, Dan? Mm-hmm. The kitchen, the people in the kitchen, or the people sitting in the pews?
I don't understand that.
No, I don't want Dan's answer, though.
Irrelevant.
Who's better off? Is either side?
Neither.
I think it's all those... things are shared without thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, when that gets shared without thinking about it, then it is. We had the interesting thing happen at St. John's in Northfield recently, where we called an assistant pastor, and I wasn't on the call committee, but someone I knew was, and we asked if any women had been called. And there was a little shuffling around, and not much was said. And finally they said, well, St. John's is really an important congregation, you know. We have to have a certain kind of leadership. And we also didn't think that there were any women coming out of the seminary yet who were able to handle the business end of the congregation, the money end. And a few other comments like that. I mean, you know, it's such a pervasive thing, and it's so subtle, it's insidiously subtle. Those instances, once I talked to the person on the call committee, were not so subtle, but most people in the congregation don't know that. A perfect place for leadership for St. John's is to call a woman as an assistant pastor. Because the small churches in South Dakota, where you and I live, are not going to do it until St. John's does, and Central Lutheran in Minneapolis, and some of the other places.
You know, I was talking about the dynamic balance that we need to achieve in ourselves. Is ideally really, I mean, I can grasp that and say, yeah, that's what I want to do, but when I think about my day-to-day life and the kind of influences that I feel that are acting on me, that's really frustrating, because I want to do something and then I have to sit and debate, well, am I doing this because men would do this, so I want to be like men? Am I doing this because I want to be a woman and be fully a woman? And it's not as clear-cut as it sounds.
That's right.
You know, it's really frustrating because there's part of me that's masculine, so am I asserting that masculine part of me, or am I copping out on being a woman and trying to be a man?
Yeah, I'm not a Jungian psychologist, but there's a chapter in here that talks about women trying to be in touch with the animus, which is this male principle, and how misled you can be that by that if you're not doing it
in the way that's profitable. But that's, it's really hard for me to understand that.
Yeah, it seems like there's a very fine line between doing that and between selling out and saying to be a man is better, so we'll try to make women into men. Mm-hmm.
Your whole discussion of the masculine and feminine, I found helpful and kind of freeing, instead of always talking about feminism, which makes it sound like a woman's movement and woman's liberation. You've made it more holistic and incorporated the idea that it's the liberation of people. But when you start dividing it in and looking into yourself, like what part of me is masculine and what part of me is feminine, we have such sexual connotations with those words that I think we still tend to think that the masculine qualities within me are not as appropriate as the feminine. And if it was something like in language, as in German and French, where words have masculine, feminine, and maybe neuter connotations, but that doesn't mean that those qualities are only qualities of men or qualities of women. If we're really talking about that, then that seems to be more helpful and more freeing for all individuals. And we can move through the boxing, and we can get to the point where we allow people to be what they are created to be, all of that little bundle of potential that can grow in time, and the strings can be cut, and all of those things can be let out. And I think we keep ignoring what Dan talked about, is how do we find the center of all this in Jesus Christ? And what was Jesus really in his person and in his action speaking of in this whole issue? And that for me seems to be the answer, that don't treat a woman according to all your definitions of woman, but look at her as a human being and allow her to be what the Creator has made her, and encourage that by non-violent, loving, revolutionary ways. It's violent when we're so feminist, and I've done this, that I arouse defensiveness in other people, then I'm not accepting them where they are in their stage of progression, and they get defensive and can't hear the impetus behind what I'm saying about feminism.
But I think the other side, I agree with you, Marilyn, but the other side of it is that we have to keep that loving and generous attitude also toward the people who are not doing it correctly, yeah. who are coming on too hard, or seeing only one angle, or have it fitting in their box too tightly. That's also our responsibility. And I know what it's like to fit in that box.
And you're still within the culture. Like, taking the other way around, how can a woman treat a man? Oh yeah, you can treat a man fully as a human being before Christ, but it's all within the culture, and he won't. You can try and draw out the feminine side and encourage him to cry if he wants to, or do things that might not be quite appropriate in the culture. But unless he somehow has thought that through already, you won't know what you're getting at. I can see what you're saying, but it's difficult.
For me, it's kind of like, do we wait to live by the kingdom values until the kingdom is completely here? Or do we begin to live upon the values that Jesus teaches us now, even though we're in a broken world? It's the same in dealing with other human beings. Do you deal with a person confined to the reality, or do you deal with them in a combination of reality and the vision of what they can be when they are more free with this loving?
Really hard question, though, when you use the words violence and non-violence, is to be loving comes across very violently when that's not the prevailing value of the culture. We can speak very, you know, generally about love, that Christ reacted, you know, lovingly to women, but I'm sure mixed up in the things that got men really angry about, you know, and caused his crucifixion, perhaps was some of his consorting with women. And, you know, what does it really mean to be non-violent and a feminist, or non-violent and liberated? Does that mean that there's going to be no conflict? See, I think that's the real nub of it now. I mean, it's easy to talk generally about Christ's love and compassion, but if I'm loving and compassionate in a non-loving and non-compassionate world, that's in violation of that world's values, and I'm going to get violated for doing it. So I think we have to prepare ourselves for the fact that even though we may strive and try to embody now in this order the integrated masculine and feminine whole love of Jesus, which is the gospel, that's not going to mean that, we know it's not going to mean the kingdom is going to be here overnight. And it may, in fact, and probably will cause some violence.
What you say about Jesus Christ, it comes to my mind of, what is it, in the eyes of God, we are all one. We are not male, we are not female, we are not children, we are not black, we are not Chinese, we are all one. You know, nothing else but one. As far as the male and female part, I don't acquiesce very much to science, but I'll give them that much credit that they have definitely defined it to a male and female role part, okay? Now, once you've worked this thing out, what you were saying about how it would relate to God, you know, to me it would seem that, you know, you have achieved that we are one in the eyes of God once you can learn to balance all these things out. All your segregations, all your prejudices, it's still, we would still be the one in the eyes of God.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
I'm one of those women that wants to do my own thing and lead my own life and develop my gifts and my talents. But I also want John to fix the flats in the car, to bring up the wood from the basement, to put in the stove, and protect me and the eco-secure. And I think a lot of times women put this on men. We want our cake and eat it too. I think that's the time.
I think it's okay to want those things. I think that men want those things too, and I think it's okay for them. Although I think they don't get them, those things.
We don't know how to think about that.
Yeah, well, it's not okay. You know, you're a man.
It's not okay to want somebody to love
you. And that's, you know, yeah.
But the thing you're saying, Mary, is that as these things begin to happen, there's a responsibility that one has to assume, that a woman is going to have to assume, and some of it may be hard. It may not be what she wants to assume when she finds out what it is she got. I don't know the answer to that.
I think if all of you who are not married, we're going to take this thing very practically. Friends of ours who both have a part-time job, they're married, they have a part-time job, they spend half the time in the home nurturing the children and the other half nurturing their intellect or whatever it is that they're doing out in their workaday world. We had three kids in diapers at one time. You know, there was 7 years when I had no chance or chose not to because I was so dead tired at night to do anything with my intellect whatsoever. Because John was a pastor, I think he had much more chance to nurture his intuitiveness, because I think pastors are in a role where they can be more intuitive. Mm-hmm. They can cry with those who are suffering and rejoice with those that are rejoicing and feel deeply with parishioners, whereas mechanics and log cutters and people that you expect to have a lot of physical strength and aren't around people where they nurture these things don't have that opportunity. So I guess if we are to nurture our intellects and our rationality and their intuitiveness, then I don't see how we continue just to have the wife raising the kids.
Yeah, exactly.
A half-time job for each with, you know, that would be one practical way of seeing, hey, I heard, excuse me, John doesn't like what I'm saying. I really agree with
That's a very good point, Mary. Yeah.
A question, John, right? That's you. Okay, all these years you've lived with John, I'm sure that in between these times, these different male and female different parts that these four people have brought up,
I'm sure there's been at times that he probably wishes that he could have asserted his femininity towards you as well as you wish that you could express your masculinity towards him. Am I right or wrong? I mean, has there even been, conscious or subconsciously that you've ever picked that up or, that in some ways that you know, I'm sure in all the years that you two have been together, hasn't there been times that you had to sit down and say, hey, we got to change some roles in one way or another. No matter what somebody thinks, we got to switch these roles. Otherwise, you'd still be taking care of the children. You wouldn't have stopped at 7 years. It would have been more like all my life that I've been with John. It would have been that you would have been with the children, right?
The thing was, about, I don't know how many years ago, John said, the next thing we do, it's going to be what you want to do. I will not accept a call. We will do the thing that you want to do. If you want to go to school or do any place in the country. And I thought, isn't this wonderful? I couldn't think of one blessed thing.
Yeah.
But Mary, there's...
And I'm so conditioned.
Well, there's a kind of timing of things, too, I think. And when people who are getting married want advice from me, one of the things I sometimes say is that the main thing David and I would do differently, and there aren't a lot of things we'd do differently. When we graduated from St. Olaf and went off to graduate school, we would have spent a lot more time and energy behind what both of us wanted to do. We put four shoulders to the wheel for David. And by the time we had spent 10 years at that, we had several kids too. And it was really hard to get back into the momentum of thinking that way and doing those things. And we also were caught in another context of other priorities, that to do that would have really jumbled them up, and we weren't sure how much risk we were willing to take to jumble those priorities.
That's why people in this room who are not married can kind of hear some of this. Mm-hmm. I really think that's...
It's just being aware. I mean, it's something we weren't aware of.
I see one problem, Mary was suggesting part-time job and people sharing the maternity parts and all, is that this society is not geared toward finding half-time jobs. If you're not successful, you don't have a full-time job. To have
it's
a
beginning.
Job means that it's lesser, you won't get as much financial remuneration, or there's all kinds of...
Extra benefits.
Built-in problems with just...
You have to figure out your priorities.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I'm not criticizing the idea of half time. I'm just saying I see a problem implementing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to take a lot of creative thinking for figuring out how are we going to, how one would do that.
It takes all those baby steps, all those individuals who finally get such a job.
That's beginning. There's a place in Seattle called Part-Time Careers where it's job sharing. You share the jobs and the benefits and the pensions and everything. And it's just beginning to happen.
It involves two people in the same field, or at least...
Yes, but it doesn't mean, it's just two people, not necessarily married, just... something I wanted to say when you were speaking with women's liberation is really men's liberation, because women can't be liberated until men can be liberated from a 40-hour week job, so they can have some time to just dink around and be creative and or whatever. And that's what people don't realize. Women's liberation is men's liberation.
Yeah.